Paul. So 2 Corinthians chapter 4, starting at verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what has been written, I believed, and so I spoke. We also believe, and so we also speak, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. For it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not only to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. For we know that if the tent, which is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed, by putting it on, we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared for us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Tommy. We're on page 21, if you want a handout. And 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Let's do a little bit of, I know there are a few people who even have joined us since after last night's meeting, so again, a little bit of recapping. The Corinthians are choosing. They're choosing between Paul and people like Paul, and what Paul calls the super apostles. The super apostles are polished and eloquent and wise and supernatural and expensive and impressive and successful. And Paul has written the chapters that we're in for the reason he gives us in 5 verse 12. We weren't there last night. He's telling us this not to commend himself, but to give us cause to boast about us, so that we'd be able to answer those who boast about outward appearance and not about what is in the heart. Because Paul has an image problem, has a success problem, certainly. If you just look even in the verses we had read just then, so verse 8, he is afflicted, he's crushed, he's perplexed. Verse 9, he's persecuted, he's struck down. And just look across the page into chapter 6. 6 verse 4, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way. What have you done, Paul, that's good, that we compare the super apostles? Great endurance in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labours, sleepless nights, hunger. what we've done so far this week, it's on the handout, we've put two inescapable facts on the table about Paul. So fact number one, he looks very, very weak. Paul doesn't try and hide that. You saw that in 6 verse 4, he is boasting about it. He looks very, very weak, chapters 1 and 2 and then later on. But last night we put fact number 2 on the table. The ministry he's in is actually very, very glorious, chapter 3. There's nothing wrong with the ministry he's in. He's actually in the only good ministry there is to be in, the one that is saving the world, bringing about life and righteousness and access and transformation. So put those two facts next to each other and say, why? Why is it like that? Why do you look so weak if the ministry you're in is so glorious? It's a good question, and Paul provides a really good answer, a knockdown answer. It makes sense, but I think it is a devastating change to the way we normally see the world. So here is verse 7. It's really what we're going to talk about all evening. Verse 7, we have this treasure, the glorious ministry. We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. So ministry, ministry is all about looking good. And that's why we call the series Looking Good. That's why Gokwan's on the front cover. Ministry is all about looking good, but it is not the minister that ends up looking good. The aim is so that God looks good. And we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. And that different way of thinking is basically all we're going to say tonight. If you get frustrated that we won't have got to point one for a while, just write a one next to where it says verse 7, so that God looks good. Just write a number one there. That'll help you keep calm as we go on. We're just going to say that several different times, and we're going to chew through some of the implications of that. Because that is a big deal thing to have said, isn't it? That the point of Paul looking weak is so that God looks good. The point of Paul being alive, really, is so that God looks good. Gospel ministry, just like being a Christian, is not so that we look good. It's so that God looks good. Same, we said on the first night there are some key verses in 1 Corinthians. Turn back to 1 verse 9. Let's check, this is what he goes on about all through the book. 1 verse 9, talking about how weak he feels. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. Why? That was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God, who raises the dead. Weakness in Paul, so that he learns to rely on God, so that God looks good. 4 verse 5. Where we were last night, we proclaim not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. He's the Lord. Go on to 11 verse 30. 11 verse 30, if I'm going to boast, if the aim is to make God look good, and if you make God look good by being a weak clay pot, what's Paul want to talk about? 11 verse 30, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness, because, bottom of the page, 12 verse 9, Jesus says, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness. Because, come back to 4 verse 7, the weaker the minister is, the better. The weaker the minister is, the better the treasure looks. I just want to prove that. I'll need two volunteers. Can I have two volunteers? Wind comes to the front. It won't hurt. There'll be no dog food. Thank you, Hattie. Thank you, Hannah. Comes to the front. Comes to the front and stand here. And could you stand back to back, please? There you go. That's great. Good. So I'm going to give you each something. Okay, and you can look at it. And I want you to decide in your head what I've given you and what you're going to say. I don't want you to be influenced by what you each say. And then in a second, you're just going to tell us what I've given you. Is that okay? Okay, so there's, I'm going to give you that. Okay, so just a little bit of time, you can have a look at what's there. Yeah, okay, there we go. Okay, so Hattie, tell us, so you've both decided what you're going to say. Hattie, tell us what you've given me, what I've given you.
You've given me a ring and a cup.
Yeah, what's the ring?
A precious ring, sparkly ring.
Yeah, And Danielle's engagement ring. Well then, Hannah, what have I given you?
You've given me like a sweet earring and a cup.
Okay, that hasn't worked at all. And just tell us a bit more, Hannah. What have I? What?
A lolly, like a lolly sweet.
That's interesting.
It's like a goblet.
Okay.
It's your cup.
Okay. There you go. Thank you. And just sit down. Thing that didn't work at all. I'd say these cups are quite different. I don't know if the point of the illustration that didn't work is that the more the cup is as impressive as the thing inside it, the more you're likely to talk about the cup rather than the thing that's in it. In this cup. Which actually, that's interesting. It's really comparative with the ring you gave Danielle, really. In this cup, there is a ring that costs 1p in there. And the cup, I don't know what this cup costs. This is Tom's christening cup. He's very excited about it. It's made of pewter. The better the cup is, and the more likely you are to say, I've got two things here. Or really, one thing. I have a cup and a sweet I can enjoy later. If the cup is pretty rubbish, and is this going to fit? It's interesting. And the ring is reasonably good, then the more likely you are to talk about the ring rather than the cup. And the ring is pretty good, isn't it? So was it Granny's diamonds? Reset, a new ring, lots of thought, lots of care, lots of expect. Are you pleased with the? whereas the cup is actually pretty much exactly what Paul means in verse 7. I guess we would think a kind of clay jar is quite nice, isn't it? That's quite nice. And they used it like this. It's disposable, and they break, and you put something in it just before you throw the cup away. And that's what Paul is saying about himself. We're disposable. We are the equivalent of the envelope that your present comes in. We're the equivalent of... did the ring come in something, Phil? Was there a kind of...
Shoebox.
Yeah, a shoebox.
Cheap box.
A cheap box, yeah, okay. Yeah. The more shoddy the cup is, the more shoddy the container... And the more interested you are in what's in it, the more it looks better. And Paul's disposable. They've noticed that. It's taking Paul quite a long time to get disposed. He keeps being beaten and getting back up again, put in prison and getting released, being beaten nearly to death and then kind of knitting himself back together again and carrying on. But there is no doubt where Paul is going. Paul is going in the bin. And that's what they've noticed about him. That's what they don't like about him. And Paul says that is entirely deliberate. Everything that you don't like about me, Paul says, is deliberate. That's God's plan. Because if we were glorious looking, you'd look at what we do and you'd think the power came from us. And you would give the glory to us. If we were eloquent and wise and expensive and strong and miraculous and successful. But you look at Paul and all you see is weakness. He's pathetic. And yet you're never going to think that Paul converted the Mediterranean world. You're never going to think that. And that's the plan. So Paul is weak. Ministry is very glorious. Why? So that God looks good. And isn't that a total game changer? That God would operate like that. And that ministry is supposed to be like that. That Christians are supposed to be like that. And I think I want to say sorry if you've been sold a different sort of Christianity to that. I think the Corinthians had been, or they'd swallowed that, not originally, but they'd picked it up. I think lots of us have been. God is not ultimately after your glory. That's not God's aim. The sweep of the Bible that we saw with Pete, his mercy, the restoration of better stuff than Eden, he hasn't done it ultimately so that things will be nice for you, not ultimately. We need to be really careful not to flip over too far and say that God wants evil things for us. God doesn't cause suffering. It's not his fault. Satan causes suffering. Satan is the fault of the people persecuting Paul. It's their own fault. God is not the one kicking Paul in the teeth. But nor is it God's ultimate aim that we would look good. That's not his ultimate aim. God's ultimate aim is that God would look good. It strikes back, right back, doesn't it, to what you first thought you signed on for when you became a Christian. Really, really important to get that right. Which means, I think, just as an aside, there's implications for how we sell Christianity to people. So here is, that I left in my room that Tommy went to find. Here is the, here's the book we gave out in my third year at university. So this is what was going swish, thud, zing in the bins in my third year rather than my first year. And it's clever because you get a gospel on that side, that's the Gospel of Mark, that way up, and you turn it upside down and you have a book by our mission speaker about Christianity. Isn't that clever? I think it's really good. So sorry, LSE, I've not written you a special themed LSE book. It's a bit shoddy. But it's quite a useful book. And in about halfway through, the speaker wrote up reasons to become a Christian. So he explains Christianity chapter by chapter. We get to a chapter called What Are the Advantages of Becoming a Christian? What are the advantages of becoming a Christian? Let me just read them to you. Even though actually just the question, do you see just the question's a bit dodgy? What are the advantages to me? What will I get out of it if I become a Christian? But here we go. Maybe the list is good. What does God do? He gives meaning to our lives. He gives enjoyment to our lives. He gives motivation to our lives. He gives power to our lives. That's interesting in 2 Corinthians terms, isn't it? He gives a new hope to our lives. And he gives new and profound relationships in our lives. End of chapter. That's an interesting list, isn't it? I think probably you could defend each one of them. You could go to the Bible and say, yeah, that is one of the advantages of being a Christian. And that's one of the good things that God gives us. It's right not to kind of suddenly become gloomy Christian. I'm really glad I became a Christian. I wish I'd become a Christian younger than I did. It's a great thing to be a Christian. But if you become a Christian after reading this book, as actually lots of my contemporaries did, it was a really, lots of people did turn to Christ that year. Then actually you signed on for enjoyment and motivation and power and new hope and relationships. And if you signed on for that and then you heard Paul say verse 7, I think you'd be a little bit shocked, wouldn't you? Paul's saying his life, a gospel life is to be like a jar of clay so that God looks good. I think, wouldn't you feel like you've been stitched up? If you've been paying attention in 1 Corinthians, I think where 1 Corinthians all hangs together is their big problem is about themselves rather than other Christians. So they want to be a Christian for the benefit of themselves rather than a Christian for the benefit of other Christians. And that's why they show off their gifts, that's why they won't give up their freedoms for other people, that's why they won't love each other, and why they won't do each other good. They want it to be for themselves rather than for other people. But 2 Corinthians takes it a step further back than that, doesn't it? And they are getting worse, I think. They're heading downwards. And the question is, are you prepared to be a Christian for God's benefit rather than your own? Are you prepared for it to be all about God? Are you prepared for Christianity to be about him rather than about you? And you put it that way, and it at one level it sounds really obvious, doesn't it? Of course a religion ought to be mainly about the God in the religion rather than the people. At one level that is absolutely obvious. But at another level it's really shocking, isn't it? Because all of man-made religion always puts us at the centre and wants a religion that will do me good and God exists to do me good. It's a really big deal though, isn't it? So Genesis 3, what was the big mistake in Genesis 3? And that was when human beings who were created by God, with God in charge and them underneath, they wanted to be more important than God. That's the big mistake, the big sin. Whereas actually, the Corinthians are doing the same thing. We want a religion that makes us look good. We want this Christianity stuff to be about us, not about God. And even Paul's life, even the beatings and the imprisonments and all those things, there is nothing there, is there, that wasn't in the documents you sign up to when you become a Christian. Whoever would come after me must take up his cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. And there's no surprises there. That's Mark 8. And that's what it is to be a Christian. Or the servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. That's John 15. There's nothing in Paul's life that takes him outside of what Jesus promised him. Nothing in it outside of what we all signed up for when we became Christians. If you sign up to the Bible's picture. If you look at the list in 6 verse 4 and 5 again. Endurance in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, labours, sleepless nights and hunger. And that's just the life of Jesus, isn't it? Paul is getting exactly what his master got before him. He's taking up his cross just like Jesus said that he would. But actually, I reckon a lot of us don't read the small print very carefully or the big print. We read to the bit that we like and prefer, which is why we complain so much in the Christian life, isn't it? Why we find it so easy to lose heart, which is what this section's trying to get us not to. In all sorts of different ways. One friend I know about recently who is giving up because fighting sin is so hard. Fighting sin is such a battle and a battle that he's losing. And his point is that it doesn't seem fair that it's so hard. And you think that resonates, doesn't it? You've got to have a lot of sympathy with that. But actually, the deal always was crucify yourself. If things are hard, that is actually what we were promised. Or how about the temptation I have to duck away from evangelism, and in particular, to duck away the moment there's some opposition. It's interesting, that little kind of duck and weave that didn't work in the white game. Here's some opposition, duck away. Why do I do that? I say in my head that I'm doing it, because if I've made them angry, clearly I'm doing something wrong. Clearly I've messed up, I should retreat, wait for them to calm down and try and find a better opportunity, an opportunity when they listen, but listen right. It means something's gone wrong, I've done it wrong, I've trodden on their toes. And it may be that, maybe I've just been rude. But actually, if you think that opposition only comes when you do it wrong, what are you saying about the ministry of Jesus? What are you saying about the ministry of Paul? If they persecuted me, Jesus says, they will also persecute you. So let's get ourselves in the right position in this religion. God is God and I am not. That's quite an important Christian truth to understand. God is God and I am not. It is all about him. I am a creature. I am a servant. Pete's talks, again, the way we swept through the whole Bible, one of the big blessings was to get back under the rule of God. To get back into being a servant. That's the aim. So God isn't ultimately after your glory. Your job, Paul's job, is to make God look good. I've put on the handout two photos that bring this home to me. We have some brilliant advertising and some crazily stupid advertising. It may be an age test. Have people seen both adverts? Okay, that's good. So there's an age test that currently we're still passing. They're both adverts for a kind of kitchen cleaner called Mr. Muscle. Apologies if you don't watch adverts in this country normally. They're kind of TV adverts over here. And for decades, the adverts were like the brilliant advert on the right of your page. Okay, so you have a puny, wimpy little man with biceps like mine in an astonishing vest and shorts. And what he's doing, Mr. Muscle, the guy, what he's doing is he's trying to clean his kitchen. And he tries to clean his kitchen and he can't do it. Poor little man, he's so weak and there's some grease on his cooker and I'm too weak and I'm tired and I can't do it. And it goes on this. And then somebody from outside the frame gives him a can of Mr. Muscle, which is the cleaner, and he just about manages to spray the Mr. Muscle on the thing. And he gets the cloth and he goes, whoosh, whoa. And he does it again, whoosh, whoosh, and he cleans his kitchen. And it ends with Skinny Man, can of Mr. Muscle, and you look at Skinny Man and his clean kitchen shining behind him, and you are absolutely clear who cleaned the kitchen. As in, it was not him and his strength, it was the product. The grease is gone. Where's the power? That is how Paul does his ministry. Weak and puny, so that it's crystal clear the power comes from God. But recently they've changed the adverts. This is ridiculous, stupid, don't know what it means about our culture. But now the guy in the advert looks like the left-hand picture, which is stunning. He's a super apostle, isn't he? He's so muscled they had to CGI him. They couldn't find an actor that they could afford who looked like that. And that means that now there is confusion. When he stands next to the clean kitchen, is he the product, or is he kind of powerful because he's powerful, or is he powerful because he uses the can of stuff? He's so strong. You just imagine him throwing the kitchen away and starting again. And wouldn't it be a horrible, cursed thing to have someone confused after a piece of ministry that you've done, the way you're confused by that left-hand advert? You're so great at it that I'm confused. Is God powerful or are you powerful? I don't know. Wouldn't that be a horrible, cursed way for it to be? And yet I find in every single piece of ministry that I ever do, what I want more than anything is for people to come out of it the other end saying, "You're great." I want to cause that confusion. Because Genesis 3 is the sin, isn't it? It is the sin that we're all into. And the Corinthians, they wanted leaders they could be proud of. They wanted leaders who looked good. And I don't think that is something that's gone away. I don't think that's just a Greek thing in that century. I think that's us. We want leaders we could be proud of who look good. We want leaders like that. But here's the thing. We already have a God like that. You already have someone you can be proud of. His name is God, or his name is the Lord Jesus. You can be proud of him. He is a great leader. He's good at everything. And you should be proud of him. In our ministers, what we want is servants of God, not competitors with God. Again, it's obvious once you say it, isn't it? But not so obvious when you're shopping. Because otherwise, they won't do anything good for their master, for God. They won't make him look good. It's actually a really encouraging thing, this. In ministry, because actually you can pretend for about 5 minutes to be capable and strong and good at things, but if you've any real sense of what's going on, you realise you're very weak. And actually quite liberating to realise that's actually what God's looking for. Looking for weak people, puny people. The advert would have that photo on the right, because that's what God needs, so that he will look great. But also, we'll go for point two. We're going to change what it says, point one, what point two really means. I think better what those verses are getting at. Not only that, verse seven, if you have a powerful sort of ministry, it won't make God look good. Second point, though, it also won't do us any good. So cross out what it says by number one and put, "So we have life in our apostles' death." You see, in verses 10, 11, 12, he talks about Jesus' death and about Paul's death. And I think we know the bit about Jesus' death. Okay, so we know that Jesus had to die so that we would live. And we understand that. That's all right, you can understand that bit. Pete talked about that bit. Jesus had to die so that we could live. We know that if Jesus had concentrated on looking good and looking super and looking impressive and not being beaten up and rejected and dying, we know that if Jesus had done that, we would still be in our sins on our way to hell. And we know that's how it works with Jesus. But why then, when it comes to the ministry we look for, do we look for a different one? We know that Jesus had to die so we could live. But actually with Paul it is the same. He's like verse 8, he's like verse 9. He's always carrying in his body the death of Jesus. Why? So that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. And verse 11 says the same again. So both times, in us death, so that in you the life of Jesus. Verse 11, in us death, so that the life of Jesus will be manifested in our mortal bodies. So that, verse 12, death is at work in us, but life in you. So here's how Paul's thought process is going. There is a town where I probably will be flogged, maybe killed. Here I am on the bench outside, in the pub outside, whatever, thinking, shall I walk down the hill and go into that town? The only decision thing for Paul then is, if I go there, will it mean the life of Jesus is revealed to people? Yep, it will. Okay, so here we go. Off I go. Let's see what happens. It's kind of like amazing, enormous game of roulette for him, Russian roulette for him. Some days I get flogged to death, some days I don't. Will it mean Jesus gets known? Yeah, then it's worth it. So a glory-seeking apostle, a glory-seeking minister, is going to stay in the pub, isn't he, basically, and leave that town and go home, which means a glory-seeking minister isn't just bad for God's glory, it's also bad for you. It's bad for us, because if he wants to keep his life, he will conceal the life of Jesus and stop the life getting out. There is no other way to carry the life of Jesus to people than to have a death-carrying body. We carry in our body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our bodies. Let's just add that to what we said yesterday. The ministry is glorious. It's the only ministry that brings change. It's the only power to match the problem that brings life. But that ministry only brings life as its ministers live a kind of death, a kind of living death. So just check that your view of Paul and the apostles matches that. So Peter does great miracles. Paul sees huge conversions. If that's what you think it is to be apostolic, to have a kind of apostle-shaped ministry, a ministry for a church living in the apostolic age, well, you need to read all the bits in between, basically, that you've left out. Or same with great figures in history. You have a big view of heroes of the faith. So that's why we did Charles Simeon as one of those seminars. If you didn't go, the first half of his ministry included his church wardens locking him out of his church, then locking the people who wanted to come to church out of the pews. They couldn't sit down. Then he bought some benches so they could sit down, so they threw them in the street. And then there were people hanging around outside trying to beat him up because he was teaching the gospel. And then he changed England, but through suffering. Or Hudson Taylor, we mentioned on the first night, person who set up OMF, millions of Chinese people, I guess, who trace their hearing the gospel back to him. But if you just read that bit of the blurb on the back, you forget that in his own day he was penniless and despised, criticised by all the other missionaries, arrested, footsore, robbed, driven from his house, because it's the death-carrying life that brings life to people. And I wonder whether you have a view of St. Helens or a view of your church at home as a place where everything goes smoothly and things are successful and without challenge. William, if he was here, William would say that every year he's been at St. Helens, William the vicar, he'd say every year there has been a major disaster of some kind. And they're often to do with individuals, they're often really sad things, and we tend not to make a big shout about them. But every single year there's been something to say, you are in 4 verse 7 ministry. This could fall apart as quickly as you like. To keep us in 1 verse 9, we rely on God only, not us. William would also say every single church plant we've ever done in its first year has had some enormous disaster or challenge. Because 4 verse 7 is where you need to be. If you're going to be a new church, you need to start life on the basis of trusting God, on the basis of being in ministry to make God look good, not on the basis of we have the right people, we have the right stuff, and let's go and do this and make this successful. Just as well, because that is the only kind of ministry that's going to do Corinthian any good. Only kind of ministry is going to do you any good is death-carrying, weak-looking ministry. Life in you only because of death in us, verse 12. So there's all sorts of ways we could apply this. Let's just think briefly about choosing churches. So one of the features of being a group of students, I hope lots of you stay in London forever and stay at St. Helens till you have grey hair. That'd be great. But many of you will go back to the country where you grew up. Many of you will go out of London somewhere else. We'll have to choose a church. And this is a kind of subtler and harder thing to look for, isn't it, than kind of false teaching. So looking out for people who deny the resurrection or deny that Jesus is coming back, that's kind of binary, isn't it? Easy in some ways. Though this will lead there, won't it? If what you want as a minister, if the minister of your church wants glory for themselves, then they will tamper with the truth, 4 verse 2, in whatever way that will lead to more glory. But on the way, it won't necessarily look like that. It won't be that easy. So we need to watch out for ministries that are marketed on how glorious the minister is or on how glorious and successful they will make you. And I think this is pretty common, actually, because sin is pretty common. That's not a surprise. But I've been on conferences where they've introduced the Christian speaker as if they were rock stars, literally. Just extraordinary spiels of stuff about them. And some of that is partly because English people are just repressed, and it is just kind of, we don't like hearing anything nice said about it. So when I introduced Pete Gaskell, I basically said, you're old, and we've known each other for a while, or something. That's roughly what I said. And being translated out of English, that means, this is my friend Pete, who I like, roughly. And so part of it is cultural. But if we want to hear rock stars, and worse, if speakers want to be introduced as rock stars, treated as rock stars, and then what they are really doing is confusing and hiding the glory of God, and they're not going to bring you life. They're not going to bring you life. They're about keeping life for themselves. It's easy to point the finger away, isn't it, though, to those kind of conferences, or sometimes you see posters around London, don't you, about churches, huge face of the minister, huge big letters about what they're good at. When it comes to choosing your next church, though, what are you going to look for? And how much is it going to be about success, competence, things that make it look good? Which, again, in English terms, might not be big posters, but might be about the social mix of people there, might be about the educational standard of people there, might be about ministry that tends to make you feel better about yourself, ministry that entertains you, ministry that cuts it against the things that the non-Christian world values. It's a real tension for us at St. Helens, actually, because we are trying to do evangelism, trying to be Jews to the Jews, Greeks to the Greeks, in an extremely intensely elitist part of the world. It's the City of London, and all the people that live there are intensely elitist and snobbish. And actually, to be honest, some of the universities in London are like that too. So it means we don't want to be shoddy. If you want to bring your friends to hear the gospel at St. Helens, you don't want an overhead projector that fails halfway through the service and kick it to try and make it work again and just says, we're just shoddy. But at the same time, saying that gives us space to make decisions that actually end up with us looking good. We're doing this so that, you know, the city person will feel we look okay. That's why I need a really expensive suit or whatever it is. It's a very dangerous thing, isn't it? So I don't know how to give practical advice. When you next choose a church, look at the website, look at the posters, look at the church magazine, listen carefully to what they say about themselves, what they say about the ministry, what they say about their ministers, what they pay their ministers, look at the type of people they employ, that sort of thing, and say, is the aim here to make God look good, or is the aim here to make themselves look good? That's the main application here. The main line here is about the Corinthians and their apostle, about Paul, about how you feel about Paul, how you feel about gospel ministry. But secondarily to that, I can also apply this to how you feel about whatever gospel ministry you're in or think you might be in the future. So, for instance, last night, Dav encouraged everybody here to think hard about being an associate, think about going into gospel ministry. Well, I guess anyone thinking about that will want to do a really big job of soul searching, the kind of stuff I've been doing a bit as I've been preparing this, and pray I'll keep doing. Because last night's talk would have said, everybody sign up, it's brilliant. Do you want to give people life? Fantastic. They'll all get forgiven. Come and do this ministry. Tonight, though, says you might really want to think very carefully, mightn't you? Because the ministry means you're signing up to be a jar of clay, signing up to be weak so that God's glory will be seen. Sign up for death in you so that life in others. And can we just have the last verse of the song we finished with last night? Is that going to be in the way? Just because I was thinking about tonight's talk, we sang it all very happily. It's a great song. Just look at the last line that we sang really cheerfully. Please glorify your name through me. I wonder as we sang it, I accept quite a lot of us just sing songs without really engaging the brain at all, but as we sang it, I wonder how many of us were imagining God would glorify his name in us by something going well, something good happening, something that would be encouraging, people becoming Christians, things like that. And I don't know what the writer of the song meant by it. Thanks, Steph, that's grand. But actually, with tonight's verse in mind, I almost didn't sing it. Because it's a good thing to sing. It's a right thing to want. It's a brilliant prayer, isn't it? But actually, with a 4 verse 7 understanding of how things work, if God's going to be glorified in me, that will mean weakness and suffering, and chances are it will mean things going badly. It's a scarier thing to pray that way. And we said earlier in the talks, I hope that we're all in gospel ministry. I hope that tonight won't put you off from doing that. But just think now, as you spread the knowledge of Jesus, as you seek to speak to people, this is what you're signing up for, to be weak rather than successful, so that everybody can tell whatever you do comes from God, not you. And just so that we don't all go away from here deciding to give that up completely, I want to just give us two encouragements out of the passage. So the last 2 points are the ways that Paul keeps himself doing this. Why keep doing this if it's like this? So verses 13 to 15, if you want to survive in this life-giving ministry, I've put 2 reasons there. I can't quite work out how this passage splits up. It's basically all about the resurrection, but I want to say something about glory as well, so I'm going to. But 2 reasons. One about resurrection. How is it Paul can be willing to sign up for this kind of stuff? Well, only because he really believes in the resurrection. The little quote there, verse 13, we have the same spirit of faith as what was written, I believed and so I spoke. That's a quote from Psalm 116, which is on your sheet. He's gone back to one of the many, many psalms in the Old Testament where you have somebody really, really suffering and really, really feeling what it's like to suffer. Please don't imagine Paul is kind of giggling as he gets beaten, that there's something kind of wrong in his head. Paul feels the pain of suffering, but he is able, he's found himself able to say, I believe in God despite it. The guy in the psalm says, in the middle of my anguish, I believed, I kept believing. And he believes, he has that spirit of faith, so he's able to say crazy things like verses 10 to 12 because he knows what happened to Jesus, verse 14. After death, Jesus was raised, and that is also going to happen. He who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. He really believes that. And actually, it's only in hard times you find out if you believe that. Only when things are scary, when you try and go and tell... what was it Pete said? He tried to tell every medical student he was a student with about Jesus, tried to talk to all of them about Jesus. It's only if you actually try something like that that you then have to find out if you actually believe in the resurrection, as I don't know what percentage of them tell you to get lost. So if you're going to survive in making evangelism a priority... you need to ask whether you believe in the resurrection. You need to spend some time really working out, do I believe in it for the people I speak to, verse 15, for their sake, and do you believe in it for yourself? Otherwise, you won't face the cost. And the last point, we're going to just look at resurrection stuff a bit more. I want to say one more thing about God's glory as well, because 15, and this is for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving, to the glory of God as well. He keeps coming back to this again and again and again. The point of being a Christian is so that God is glorified. And I wonder what you think about that. You need to be able to be in that ministry. You need to believe that that is a good thing. You need to believe that God being glorified would be a good thing. And non-Christians really often say what I think we really often think, which is, isn't that basically just a bit big-headed of God? Isn't that a bit arrogant of God to want the world set up so that he looks good? And that's because we misunderstand glory, and we must understand what that's really about. So just think for a second. It is bad, isn't it? Pig-headed, arrogant, all those things. It's bad to want glory that you don't deserve. It is horrendous, isn't it? And embarrassing when you do it, and to pretend to be better at something than you really are, to pretend to be worth more than you really are. And that is the pig-headed thing. Just think for a second. Is it possible for God to do that? Is it possible for God to pretend to be better at something than he really is? Is it possible for God to say that he is worth more than he really is? So actually, you just need to get your head around what God is really like. So, for instance, with our musicians, when you say to a musician, when Andy's trying to persuade someone to play, and he says, are you good enough, do you think, to play on a Sunday night? Are you good enough at singing? Are you good enough at guitar to do that? It's not big-headedness if somebody is good enough to say, yes, I'm good enough to do that. That's not big-headedness. And that is actually servant-hearted, isn't it? It's truthful, it's useful. We can make them big-headed if we kind of fawned all over them, which is why we don't put them on a stage and that sort of thing. But if you say, no, I'm really bad at singing. Oh, I'm rubbish, I can't play at all. When you're lying, that's not humility. That might be laziness. It might be kind of something you were made to play in the front too much when you were a child and something weird happened in your head. It might be all sorts of things. But it's not humility, is it? And actually, for God, it would be much, much more serious if he did that. We've been thinking about idolatry quite a bit this week, haven't we? So idolatry is a horrible sin. When you worship something that isn't God, so when you worship sex or you worship money or you worship Baal, you worship something else when really God deserves all the glory. You give the something else glory that God deserves because he's the creator and the only glorious one. And now here's a question somebody asked me that really turned the lights on for me. Help me with this. How do you think that God, if God was going to commit idolatry, what would God have to do to commit idolatry? So idolatry is putting worship on something that isn't God, taking some of God's glory and giving it something to isn't God's. The only way God could commit idolatry would be if he allowed some of his glory to go, or any glory, to go somewhere else. And because God really is the one, what we sang in the songs, actually, the first few songs, he really is the one who deserves everything, all the glory. If he seeks the glory, that is actually the right thing for him to do. That's a good thing for him to do. If he allows it to go somewhere else, that is idolatry. And you need to believe that if you're not going to get grumpy being a clay pot. It's the right thing when he gets the glory. But I want to end with giving you some work to do. There will all be work about the resurrection. Let me just introduce it, and then I'll give you a bit of time with a piece of paper on your own. So last point, everything from verse 16 to 5 verse 10. We don't lose heart because of the future. Because of the future, and actually because of how good what God has planned for us. I hope, I've been kind of holding this one back, trying not to give it away too early. I kept crossing it out and moving it later in the talk because I really want us to feel the force of God is not ultimately in it to make you look good. Feel the force of that. That is not the big aim of the plan. The aim of the plan is that glory would go to God, and we accomplish it by being clay pots. So it's clear that it's his power that does it. But let's just now tell you about the plan he has decided will most make him look good. What is the thing that will most make God look good, will most glorify God for eternity, is if he is stupendously, amazingly generous to stupid, rebellious, sinful, weak clay pots like us. Isn't that a crazy plan? But isn't that a good plan? Verse 16, that means that now our outer nature is wasting away. But you can't tell a spirit-on-heart Christian that's a big deal because their inner nature is being renewed and they know about the future. Verse 17, God is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comprehension. It's not deserved. It's not because you were a good clay pot. It's not because you're a deserving person. It's just given. But he is preparing an enormous weight of glory. Weirdness all round, isn't it? So God would commit idolatry if he allowed any of the glory to go somewhere else. But having done everything to make sure he gets all the glory, he then says, do you want to share it with me and my children? And that is what is God doing now? God is preparing that glory for us. So I don't know what you prepared. You think God's quite old. He made me sit at home doing some knitting or some jigsaw puzzles. God is at home preparing, building, getting ready glory so that he can share it with you. That's what he's going to do at the end of his plan. God isn't horrible. Quite a lot of points one and two, you might just think God's horrible. He'd still be God, it would still be okay, he'd still be God. But actually, God is not horrible. He's not using us uncaringly, the clay pots. You're not going to end up saying, I'm a clay pot and he used me and I'm grumpy about it. We will end up stunned by his generosity and by what he had planned for us all along. We need to make sure we're thinking about that glory in the future rather than now. So now our outer nature is wasting away, but then inner nature renewed for glory. So I want us to think about three things when we do some thinking. One is to get the time scale right. So verse 17, there are some things that are slight and momentary. And compared to them, those are our troubles. Compared to them, the glory is eternal and weighty. Verse 18, the things we can see in front of our face are transient, and the things that are unseen are eternal. So I've put a timeline for you to help you think about that on the bottom of the page. It's not to scale. The cramped little thing on the left is everything that Pete took us through. That's the entire history of time on this planet, from the creation of the world through to Jesus, through to the last 2,000 years, through to the dotted line there, if you can just about see that, which is however much time there is left until Jesus comes back. And it's not to scale because that bit is far too big, because the remaining arrow is meant to say eternity, going on off out the page and on. Now, light and momentary troubles that don't last very long at all, if you get it in time scale and say the glory God has prepared for us is eternal. Second thing you might like to think about is the house he has ready for you to move into in chapter 5. This is like any property program you've ever seen, where we're comparing houses. And this body, the body that we're being asked to give up to death so that life can be seen, even some of the kind of very solid wall-like bodies that I tried to run through during the game, those bodies are basically, verse 1, a tent. They're just a tent that's going to be destroyed. And if you thought about them properly, you would see that they are drafty and cramped and flimsy compared to the eternal home that's waiting, the body God's going to give us, verse 2. So we begin to groan for something better, which is a feature of our camping holidays as a family. After we've been in the tent for a little while, you begin to say, actually, a house is better. You think about where you're going and what you're going to get, naked versus clothed is saying the future is not one of loss. This body's going to get worn out. You're going to get a better one. And better than all those things, last thing to think about, verse 6 to 10, is about who will be there. A reason not to be comfy in this body, not to be at home here, because to be at home here is to be away from the Lord. Which I guess, again, for overseas students, there can be nice things about being in London, nice, happy things about being here and the exciting weather we have for you to enjoy and that sort of stuff. But to get too at home in London is to forget that your family lives somewhere else, is to be comfortable being away from them. Paul can say, verse 8, that he has good courage. You can't scare him with what's going to happen to his body, as he proves again and again and again, because he'd rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. And whatever happens, verse 9, he's going to try and please the Lord while he's here. I want to suggest some things you might do with a piece of paper now that would kind of maybe then you do in more detail later on. Make some lists. Make a list maybe of all of Paul's sufferings. There's a few places in these verses I've shown you, kind of things he went through. There's another longer list in, is it chapter 11? I think it is, yeah, the end of chapter 11. Then also make a list of the sort of worst case of what might happen to you if you really went for it and made speaking about Jesus a priority. So if you, as a CU of four people in Sidcup, if you decided to hold an enormous mission on your own and try and tell everyone, if you did try and tell every other medical student in your uni, whatever, make a list of the kind of worst case trouble that you would get into. Not kind of ridiculous things, so aliens will not come and eat you, they will not set you on fire, I doubt. But the kind of, if it went really badly, the sort of afflictions and troubles you might get. And then third list, go through some of those things we've just touched on, and make a list of what might be good about the eternal glory that God has prepared for us. And then the job is to begin praying through the list next to each other, the suffering list and the glory list, and see if we can begin to say what Paul said, to look in the face of the very real trouble you might get, and to be able to say slight and momentary in comparison. I don't know, you know, I guess it doesn't feel momentary when you're being flogged 40 times. Slight and momentary, because of what is coming. I reckon I'm going to give you about 5 minutes to make a start on that on your own, and then I'll stand up again. Sorry to cut in before you've had very long. I think I'll read some of Revelation 21, where Pete left us at the end of the session today, and then try and tie that with what we've just said. So if you really believe in the future, then maybe 4 verse 7 would make sense. So then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. So we do not lose heart, for this slight momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. I think Tom has ready some more songs for us to sing.